Yes. Mr. Chandelbold? Mr. Wynn, okay.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Wynn.
From the Public Defender's Office of Chesapeake.
All right. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please.
All right. We're glad to hear
you. Your Honor, our argument is that the trial court erred in convicting the defendant of possession of firearm by violent felon, that this was, in essence, a retroactive recategorization of his burglary conviction of 1994 from nonviolent.
All right. Let me stop you right there. You phrased it as a retroactive recategorization.
Yes, Your Honor.
You didn't use the words ex post facto. So what's wrong with the retroactive recategorization?
Your Honor, we believe that it's unfair to the defendant. In fact, in 1994, if I could just establish these critical dates, he was found guilty of burglary in Tazewell County. A few months later, 17.1805 was enacted, and basically it made burglary a violent offense by statute. In 1999, there was 18.2-308.2, which made possession of firearm by violent felon a 5-year mandatory offense. Then in 2013, the defendant was convicted of possession of firearm by violent felon. So the issue is, in our opinion, he was punished retroactively for that. At the time,
the sentence was enhanced, certainly.
Yes,
now,
Your Honor.
Now, let me stop you right there. How do you deal with the case of the United States against Rodriguez, the U.S. Supreme Court case?
Judge, I'm not familiar with that case.
Let me quote from that.
I have all the relevant cases here.
When a sentence is increased based on the defendant's criminal history, 100% of the punishment is for the offense of conviction. None is for the prior convictions or the defendant's status as a recidivist. The sentence is a stiffened penalty for the latest crime.
I understand that, Your Honor. We also...
Isn't that what we have here, though?
Well, Your Honor, at the time he was convicted of the burglary conviction in Tazewell County, 17.1805 had not been enacted, so he had no notice of an enhanced punishment that would come later in time.
But he did after passage of the statute, right?
A few months later.
So then he commits the crime after the statute was enacted.
He committed the crime before 17.1805 was enacted, which delineated...
crime of possessing the...
Well, the 18.2 firearm statute was enacted in 1999. His burglary conviction was 94, and 17.1805 was a few months after his initial conviction. Now we come to 2013. And he commits the crime, he's convicted. So some almost 20 years later, we argue that it's unfair to go back retroactively in an ex post facto constitutional violation manner and punish him for what happened in 1994.
But counsel, what case do you have to support your proposition that you can't do that with regard to sentencing?
Please let Judge Decker finish your question before you...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, with regard to sentencing.
Well, Your Honor, I acknowledge the Dotson case in 1996 indicates that this is not an ex post facto violation. But then we have the Preston case, and that was 2011, I believe, Virginia Supreme Court case. And this case said the Commonwealth was required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant was previously convicted of a violent felony defined in 17.1-805 in order to show that the 5-year mandatory minimum came into play. If not, it had to be a 2-year sentence. And that's what the Supreme Court of Virginia said, 281 Virginia 52.
Well, that case doesn't deal with an ex post facto analysis, does it?
Yes, sir, it does. It does, absolutely. And it's 2011. Again, 281 Virginia 52, the Preston case. And so we also have the Turner case, 38 Virginia Appellate 851 2002, where there was a housebreaking conviction based on, and this is Virginia Court of Appeals, but there was a housebreaking conviction used under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And that also was reversed and remanded for resentencing. And so Virginia courts have recognized that maybe this retroactive application results in the 5-year statute not being applied, that we should go back and resentence, remand for the 2-year statute to be applied. Because, again, at the time he was convicted, there was no evidence that burglary was, quote-unquote, a violent predicate felony. So,
well, ex post facto concept, at least as the founders envisioned it, simply was you don't get you can't try someone for a crime that wasn't a crime at the time they did whatever the deed was that ultimately made a crime. And that isn't really precisely what we have here. What we have here is a situation where the crime has been on the books a long time, but the punishment was enhanced because of, as you put it, a recategorization of the way a particular aspect of criminal history is looked at in terms of sentencing.
Yes, Your Honor.
So I guess my initial question was to what degree do any of the ex post facto cases apply to sentencing as opposed to the criminal act itself?
Well, Your Honor, I think the Attorney General argues that the date of the present offense is basically outcome determinative, and we are saying that the defendant was punished at the time he was recategorized as a violent offender. And just under fundamental notion...
How does that follow? He hadn't... I mean, when the General Assembly passed that particular statute, he hadn't done anything except occupy space within the Commonwealth of Virginia, so...
But you're... You know, we're talking about he's been punished for the burglary in 1994, and then...
But he wasn't punished for anything else, as Judge McCall pointed out a moment ago,
true.
until he committed a new criminal act.
That's
true. If he committed
true.
A new criminal act, then he's presumed to know what the law is at the time he committed that act.
But at the time of the offense in Tazewell County in 1994, was it burglary with intent to commit larceny? Is that violent? Was it burglary with intent to commit robbery or rape, which is arguably violent?
So under your theory, when the General Assembly passed a statute that made third and subsequent offense petty larceny or shoplifting an enhanced crime, anyone who had committed prior burglaries or shopliftings was not exposed to any additional...
I understand, Your Honor, but this is a five-year mandatory statute that he's being exposed to some 20 years later, and again, not to be redundant, but it just seems like...
No, he didn't expose himself to it until he committed the new crime.
And again, I can see...
With the knowledge that burglary is a violent crime.
Understand. And again, this is the best argument we can make.
You're making it very well.
This is the best argument we can make, but I do ask the court again to look at Preston and Turner, which are recent Virginia cases, where the court reversed, particularly in the Preston case, because they went into the juvenile adjudication, and so did Dodson, basically. It wasn't clear from the court's disposition order as to what the nature of the circumstances were that constituted the burglary, but that was a juvenile adjudication and other issues there. I did want to bring one case to the court's attention. I know it's not a Virginia case, but it's State versus Trower out of South Dakota. And in State versus Trower...
Can you give us a cite on that?
Is that in your brief or anybody?
Yes, Your Honor. I can give you a cite.
Well, it's in your brief.
It's in my brief. It's 629 Northwest 2nd, 594, 2001. And the court cites U.S. versus Davis, which I believe is a Virginia federal case. And the court said that the firearm conviction violated the ex post facto law because a sexual contact offense was not defined as a crime of violence at the time of offense. And they do mention U.S. versus Davis, which is mentioned.
But here it was defined as a crime of violence at the time of offense. That seems to me to be the
distinction. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I have to concede that. But they do mention a Virginia case, U.S. versus Davis. And I think this is a very tough case for us, but a very interesting case. One reason is, again, it's been since 1996 that Dodson was a case against us, but then we have Preston and Turner much more recently offering some relief. And again, Preston reversed and ruled in favor of the appellant in that case. And then Turner, they reversed and they affirmed the conviction, but they remanded for resentencing, and I believe ultimately the defendant was sentenced to 2 years versus five. And so there is some justification, I think, for our argument.
So, if we happen to agree with you, the answer would be not a new trial, but a remand for resentencing. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I think there would be strong justification for remanding for resentencing.
Because one of the things we have to do is figure out a disposition, and sometimes the disposition is the problem is with the sentence, and so that you don't need to retry the case.
I would agree with you, Your Honor.
And you have to retry.
That would be adequate relief. But I would bring this point up that Dodson in 96 did not in any way consider 17.1-805. And I think that's important because you've got to weigh that in with 18.2-308.2, which is a five-year statute. And so Dodson didn't even mention 17.1-805 at all. And so I think that this is a very relevant inquiry today on this issue. And it's a major issue because I'm arguing the statute is unconstitutional, which is a major position to take, and a risky one. But someone has to make the tough calls on these things. And I think that the two recent Virginia cases should be examined and applied to the facts of this case, where there is some relief. Thank you.
Mr. Chandler.
Morning. May it please the Court. I'm Chris Chandler for the Commonwealth. I'll make a quick point on the disposition in this case, since that's what we were just talking about. As I noted in my brief, if you read the trial transcript, what counsel argued at, in the trial was that the conviction would be an ex post facto violation, and the court told counsel that at this time I'm going to find your client guilty of being a violent felon in possession of a firearm. You can save that argument for sentencing. And then when you read the sentencing transcript, it's clear that counsel actually asks the court to impose a mandatory minimum sentence and does not re-raise the constitutional argument about it being ex post facto violation to sentence him to the mandatory minimum. So my argument on appeal is that the only issue before the court at this time is really whether the conviction itself constitutes an ex post facto violation and not whether the sentence for the mandatory minimum constitutes an ex post facto violation.
Your opposing counsel puts a lot of weight on the Preston case in particular. What's your response to that argument?
The Preston case, my response would be that the opposing counsel misreads Preston. Preston is a sufficiency challenge to whether or not the evidence was sufficient to prove that Mr. Preston had been convicted of a prior violent felony. And the trouble with the sufficiency argument in that case was the fact that the prior violent felony that was being used in that case was a conviction for being a delinquent juvenile on a breaking and entering charge. And the deficiency in the evidence was the JNDR court's order did not clarify what exactly the defendant pled guilty to.
One of the cases where the Commonwealth introduces an order and the order is murky, and so we're not exactly sure
right. What
the underlying conviction is. Here, there's really no doubt what the underlying conviction is.
Right, and I think when you read Preston, it's clear that the court assumes that if it had been clear that he had been convicted of what he had been charged with, which was breaking and entering, then he would have been properly convicted of being a felon, a violent felon in possession of a firearm.
And if it was a sufficiency analysis, that would preclude any constitutional analysis anyway, because you presume that you ignore all those kinds of admissibility issues and sufficiency.
Right. So the constitutional argument was never addressed in that case.
Counsel, let me just make sure I understand your procedural bar argument.
Yes.
So your point is that at trial, the ex post facto challenge was to the guilt phase, to the actual conviction.
Yes.
And that it was not what it is on appeal, which is the sentencing. And so your point would be it's procedurally barred.
Correct, Your Honor. And if you look at page 108 of the appendix, counsel actually asked the court, I request that you impose a mandatory minimum in this case at sentencing, and never goes back and makes another argument about the ex post facto, supposed ex post facto violation, never asks the court for a ruling on that issue as to the mandatory minimum sentence. The reason why I think that's important is because if we're just looking at the conviction, this case really is controlled by Dodson. Dodson dealt with a conviction for being a felon in possession of a firearm. The only difference here is that he was convicted of being a violent felon in possession of a firearm. But I don't think that should change the result to any extent, because the reasoning in Dodson was that the legislature was just regulating, using its regulatory power to regulate the possession of firearms. And for that reason, this is really more of a civil disability as opposed to a criminal punishment. And for that reason, there's no ex post facto violation as to the conviction. I think that controls whether it's just someone convicted of a run-of-the-mill felony or a violent felony. That conviction, that result should still hold. I would like to also clarify something in my brief. If the court does, assuming the court does decide to reach the issue of whether the sentence itself constitutes an ex post facto violation, I will note that there is a small distinction in some of the case law as to the proper analysis. I think courts take two different approaches to these ex post facto challenges. One is to question whether the sentence is even punishment in the first place, or whether it's just a consequence of a civil disability. So in rereading Dodson, it appears that the Dodson court is really treating the conviction as, I think the exact language is, that it's a relevant incident to the state regulation of firearms. So really treating this more as a civil disability as opposed to criminal punishment. And so I would argue that...
Someone going to prison for violating a criminal statute is a civil... As opposed to someone cannot possess a firearm after conviction of a certain... I mean, that is clearly a civil disability.
Right, but in order for the legislature to enforce that civil disability, the legislature also attached consequences, which includes someone going to prison. And the 11th Circuit...
Here we're talking about a mandatory minimum, right?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
That's different.
Well, I think it is different, but I think the analysis, I would argue the analysis still leads to the same result.
Well, the case law, it seems to me, is pretty clear that what constitutes an ex post facto problem isn't totally dependent on whether somebody classifies something as civil or criminal. I mean, you look at the sanction, you know, are they being deprived of a property right or a liberty interest, that sort of thing. I think there's some case law that suggests that even in a regulatory context, a heavy fine would be considered within the ambit of an ex post facto analysis, even though it's classified by a legislature as civil in nature.
Correct. I think the courts take those two different approaches. So many courts will look at a case like this and simply say, well, which crime is he being punished for, the underlying offense or the crime of being a felon in possession of a firearm? And under that analysis, I think the result, the conviction should be affirmed in this case, because assuming that he's being punished for being a felon in possession of a firearm, the 2013 offense, long after the statute was amended to include this as being a violent felony. I would submit, though, that some courts take a different approach. And I'll cite to the court United States versus O'Neill. I've included it in my brief. It's a Fourth Circuit case from 1999. And there's a whole long analysis in that case as to what constitutes punishment. And in that case, it actually was a sentence enhancement. And the court concluded that he actually wasn't being punished. It was actually more of a civil disability. And the court cites a test from the First Circuit, a case called Cases versus United States. And the test that the court applies to determine whether the defendant is being punished or whether it's more of a civil disability is whether the past conduct that is being used to determine the ultimate unfitness to participate in this later activity. So you look at the underlying conduct and ask, is that conduct indicative of this person being unfit to later engage in whatever activity is being regulated? So the question in this case would be whether a violent felony is indicative of someone who is now unfit to engage in the conduct of possessing a firearm. And I think under that analysis, it would be clear that someone who commits a violent felony, the legislature could determine, is no longer fit to have a firearm. It might be different if the result would be that he's no longer fit to vote. You might say that there's not as much of a parallel there. But under that analysis, I think that this really could be considered to be more of a civil disability, the consequence of a civil disability that analysis.
Even if it being sent to prison for violating a criminal statute, it's called a crime, is punishment, it still wouldn't be an ex post facto problem if it's a brand new set of facts that the defendant engaged in long after passage of a new statute.
Correct. And it leads to the same result, but either analysis leads to the same result. So in my attempt to clarify, perhaps I've obfuscated.
No, I mean, you're just saying there are two paths open to the court. They both lead to affirmance, but they're just different.
Correct, Your Honor, and I didn't want to gloss over.
One seems to be pretty tortured, but perhaps that's where the law is, and then the other is...
Right, and again,
more straightforward.
The courts have taken both approaches. In the case that Your Honor cited, Rodriguez, I think I cited a case in my brief, Reynolds, out of the 11th Circuit, which cites United States Supreme Court case law, which says that a sentence enhancement of this sort is just a stiffened penalty for the most recent offense. And so under that analysis, there is no ex post facto violation. There's no additional punishment for the underlying predicate felony. And so... under that analysis, this is not an ex post facto violation.
The other case your opposing counsel pointed out, I believe, is Turner. Did you have any comments on that?
Turner is a case involving a conviction for housebreaking under the UCMJ. And so the question there is whether a conviction for housebreaking is sufficient to constitute a violent felony under the statute, because, of course,
I consider this substantially similar when you're dealing with other jurisdictions.
Right, exactly. And here we have a statute which spelled out, statutory burglary spelled out in the statute. This is considered a violent felony.
So we don't have to parse a foreign statute to figure out how closely analogous it is to the Virginia law.
That's correct, and that's why Turner is not applicable here. Unless there are any further questions, I'll rest on my brief and ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. Mr. Wynn?
Thank you.
You know, you guys are allowed to sit at council table.
I'm sorry. A couple of things. Just a comment on my opposing counsel's comments about the sentencing. Just to set the context straight, when the trial judge says, I have no choice, literally, and it's in the transcript, but to give him the 5 years, I want the court to know that I was asking him, I had already raised all these arguments at trial, but basically I was asking him in the context of sentencing to please just give him the mandatory minimum that you have to give him and don't give him anything additional.
Well, I gather that, but let me follow up on that, yes, if I could. And what about the Attorney General's contention that the issue wasn't preserved because it was never actually raised at sentencing, only raised in the context of the guilt or innocence aspects of the ex post facto application?
Well, Your Honor, that's correct, but I do believe that, you know, all throughout the trial, I objected and made all the proper preservations at that point.
So basically, it's close enough for government work as far as you're concerned.
Well, I don't mean to be sloppy about it. I no means imply that.
Well, how
that.
Would you tell the trial judge what remedy an appellate court ought to impose? I mean, that's just not the forum.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand that. But I do think it was duly preserved. And I wanted to make a correction on the record. U.S. versus Davis was the 8th Circuit. I think I may have said 4th. I was thinking of Etheridge, but I don't want to mislead anybody. But I do want to just comment on Turner again. And Turner said, in proof of a prior predicate felony, the Commonwealth relied on the earlier conviction of defendant by court-martial for housebreaking. But there was no evidence that the crime was a violent felony, and so the court reversed the sentence. I mean, it overturned it. And that was 2002. That was the Court of Appeals of Virginia. And in Trower, again, the court said, Trower was convicted of a felony, and later an amendment was passed barring felons in his situation from carrying firearms. Thus, the question here is the same question presented in Davis, whether this new bar on firearms possession constitutes an ex post facto law as applied to Trower. Just as in Davis, we hold that it does. Again, that's not a Virginia case, but I've cited it in my brief, and I wanted the court to know that.
Counsel, so let me just ask you one last question.
Yes, Your Honor.
At least one last question from me. You know, we look at trial court error.
Yes,
that's,
Your Honor.
That's what this court does. How can you actually say that the trial court erred in rejecting your ex post facto argument with regard to sentencing in this case?
I think by implication that if this court deems the statute to be unconstitutional under the U.S. Constitution and the Virginia Constitution as a retroactive ex post facto violation of those constitutions, then by implication, he committed error. Was he following Virginia law?
But did you give him an opportunity to make that ruling?
I believe I did in the motion to strike phase. I brought all these arguments up and argued very lengthy analysis on the record as our position. And he said, I believe, and I quote, I have no choice. And so we're
Your position is you argued ex post facto with regard to the sentencing, not the guilt.
Pretty much so. Because there was clear evidence he had the firearm, he had sold it, he had stolen it from his roommate, his friend. And so there was clear evidence that he had the firearm. So we're arguing that the statute's unconstitutional. And that's where we are. So there is authority for our position in Virginia courts also. Again, please consider the context of my argument that I know you have to give him this, but I don't want you to give him more because if there was another charge or so involved, I wanted all that time suspended. And he did suspend all that time. So it's an interesting analysis. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wynn. We're going to come down to the council and then take Bruce Antoine Howard against the
council. All right.